Verse 20 of chapter 7 of Hebrews. And it was not without an oath. Others became priests without any oath. But he became a priest with an oath when God said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever." Because of this oath, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. Now there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office. But because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. Such a high priest meets our needs, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who are weak, but the oath which came after the law appointed the Son who has been made perfect forever. The point of what we are saying is this: we do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the Majesty in heaven and who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by man. Every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, and so it was necessary for this one also to have something to offer. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, for there are already men who offer the gifts prescribed by the law. They serve at a sanctuary that is a copy and shadow of what is in heaven. This is why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle: "See to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." But the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is the mediator is superior to the old one, and it is founded on better promises.
Hebrews. Fascinating book, isn't it? So many insights, so much picked up from the Old Testament, but brought firmly into the New. It appears to be addressing a load of people who are thinking of going back on their belief. I mean, really and truly, anyone in their right mind who understands what we've just been singing would go back to what they knew before. Is it possible? Well, it seemed to be possible. Why would they want to go back? I don't know. Maybe persecution. Maybe it was doubt, perhaps. Back to their Jewish religion. And the writer to Hebrews comes up with some solutions to their problem. On the one hand, I think he's saying, really, their view of Jesus is just not big enough. Yeah? And the second thing is, they stopped part way and they haven't pressed on to everything that really has been brought about by Jesus and God is wanting to put into our lives and bless us with. And that, it seems to me, is what Hebrews is trying to say to us. It's no good stopping part way. You've missed what it's all about. It's no good having an incomplete view of Jesus. Both of those leave you up in a messy situation. The thing is, they can affect us all. And that's why this book with its message is so relevant to us. Yeah, we haven't come from a Jewish background, I'm sure most of us haven't. But the issue is still here with us. Our view of Jesus mine isn't, so I don't know what yours is, but I'm going to guess it's not big enough. And it could be bigger, whatever it is. And certainly, there is so much to press on to know in and through him. So, here we are, the book of Hebrews. It's designed really to exalt the Lord Jesus Christ and to build our confidence in him, so that by the time we finish reading it, we will have no doubts about where we stand as far as salvation goes. We'll have no doubt in our minds and hearts just to who Jesus is. And we will be pressing on hard to know what God has for us. And so in coming to this conclusion, driving us to this conclusion, the writer to Hebrews has taken us down this pathway. He's saying really there's no one to compare with Jesus. Absolutely not. You look at the angels and you realize that they are just messengers. Whereas Jesus is the Son of God, who is the radiance of his glory, the express image of his being. And Jesus cannot but help portray to us the whole nature of God, not just give a message about him, because the nature of God is within him. He's better than Moses. Moses could only serve. But Jesus is the Son. There's a whole world of difference between what the Son can do and be to what someone who is a servant can do. And Moses did a pretty good job. But boy, he can't get anywhere near what Jesus is able to do. Joshua, yeah, he did a good job as well. He got the children of Israel into their promised land. He brought them into a kind of settlement there, but it was a temporary thing, it was an earthly thing, and they were still beset by their enemies. But Jesus brings us not into an earthly rest, but into a heavenly rest, but also a rest that affects us here down on earth. And we get the best of both worlds with Jesus. And he's better than Aaron, of course, which is where the section is that we're in at the moment. Aaron and all those priests that came after him, they had beset with human weakness. They failed. Some of them were rejected. But not this one. Not this priest that we have. He's perfect. He cannot fail. And there's the message. There's no one better placed to meet our need than Jesus. It said those words. Such a high priest meets our need. And if you look at the life of Jesus, you look at things Hebrews saying about him, you realize that Jesus and all that he is and all that he has accomplished, you have to conclude that he is not just a better option than these others. He is better by far. But he's not only better by far, but actually in meeting our need, he is actually the only one who could do what he did and meet our need. He is, after all, unique. And that's where this business about Melchizedek has been saying to us, that actually Jesus isn't in the line of the priests of the Aaron line and all the rest of that. And it's not just in saying that he's a priest after the order of Melchizedek. It's not just saying, well, how come Jesus isn't part of the tribe of Levi, so how could he possibly be a priest? It's actually saying to us that because he's not of the tribe of Levi, and because he is of this order of Melchizedek, actually Jesus is a priest in a different realm. He's a trace of a different strata. He is in a different league entirely. There are striking differences between Jesus and these other priests. One of which we started with in that reading, in that he was appointed by oath. Aaron and his people, they were all appointed because they were hereditary. God appointed Aaron in the first place, but they then followed the line. And they were priests till they died, of course. Some of them actually fell out of favor before that because, well, they basically failed, didn't they? We had some examples of that in Samuel, where Hophni and Phinehas, they were priests who were selfish intention. They just used the office to suit themselves. And so God said that they would be rejected along with Eli's line. We have other examples of priests who actually failed in the midst of their duties. Nadab and Abihu, sons of Aaron, so very early on in the thing. And yet they rushed into God's presence without preparing themselves properly. They didn't take the proper offering with them. And so they too met a sudden and disastrous end. We don't have a priest like that. We have someone who is permanently in post. Because the oath said, you are a priest forever. Forever. A priest who can never lose his position of priesthood. A priest who can never fail and be rejected. Because he is the Son of God. And the qualities of this priest are just simply surpassing. He's holy, it says here. This is the high priest who meets our need. One who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. And here in a nutshell is Jesus. He has those personal qualities. He is the genuine article. His devotion to God is absolute, 100%. And his devotion to us is absolute, 100%. You don't get a priest like that in the Old Testament. He's blameless. He's pure. There's nothing in Jesus that would ever make you doubt that he's genuine about what he's doing. There's nothing within him that's going to trip him up and lead him to fail in bringing us to God and bringing God's forgiveness to us. He doesn't have a personal agenda like those other priests, some of them did. He's there for us and to reflect the heart of God in what he's doing. He's set apart from sinners, which means, of course, that he's not going to be influenced by any evil influences ever, because he is above and beyond and well apart from anything like that. There's nothing in Jesus that's going to lead him away from this wonderful position he's in of being our high priest. And he is exalted. Now what that means, of course, is that he's sat down at the right hand of God, which means God has simply approved him. Not only has he given him the oath that says you are a priest forever, but he's made sure that he's sitting there in the place of authority as a priest. And he's sitting there having done his work and got it accomplished. And he's unlike those priests who, in the Old Testament, they stood and did their duties because they had to walk out again. And the Old Testament, the practice was, in fact, that they used to tie a rope to his foot. You remember, you know about this probably, don't you? The high priest had bells on his garment, and they tied a rope to his foot. So they went into God's presence. Something might have happened to him. If he'd not gone in quite right, if there was something in his own life he hadn't sorted, and he stood in the holy presence of God, that would be it. And the only way they could get him out was to pull him out with the rope. That was it. It might sound strange, but we have a high priest who doesn't run that danger. He is actually sitting in the presence of God, the Father, having accomplished what he's accomplished. And it just simply proves that God has approved of everything that he is and that he's done, and there's no question about it. What a priest to have. He meets our need. And the simple fact is that if we don't realise we've got a need, then we won't appreciate Jesus. It's probably as simple as that. It's also as simple that the more we appreciate our need, the more we will appreciate Jesus. Isn't that also true? And it says here that he is able to save completely those who come to God through him. Well, the old version said to the uttermost, didn't it? He's able to save to the uttermost. And the uttermost gives you the impression of how much Jesus is able to save. There's breadth and range to uttermost, isn't it? You know, it doesn't matter what corner of the world you come from, the salvation of Jesus can reach. It doesn't matter what kind of background you've got, what kind of race you're from or tradition you're in. All types of persons, whatever. Jesus, as priest, encompasses the whole lot. And there's depth to it as well, isn't there? From the deepest, most deep and dark thing that we've ever done, his priesthood is able to minister God's grace to. Or as somebody once said, he is able to save from the guttermost to the uttermost. And I think really, the guttermost is it, really, isn't it? In terms of our moral standards, in terms of where we stand before God and how much we've been able to obey him in our lives and the things that we are capable of, human beings, it's good if we can realize that actually, in those terms, we are guttermost. But he lifts us up and he is able to deliver us and save us to the uttermost. And coupled together with his indestructible life and his forever being priest, that means all of this is true forever. I just pause for a moment while that sinks in. Because sometimes it is hard, isn't it, for these things to really hit us. So then, the qualifications and qualities of this priest surpass any other. But so does his sacrifice. That's what he goes on to say, doesn't it? There's no priest with a better sacrifice than his, because the sacrifice that Jesus offers is actually himself. It's an unusual situation. But this priest actually carries himself as a sacrifice to God. And there can be no better sacrifice than Jesus himself. So there's no more perfect sacrifice. The Old Testament sacrifices had to be perfect, but you and I know that nothing is absolutely perfect. And in fact, it's quite clear, as Hebrews actually does go on to tell us, it's quite clear that animal sacrifices were never actually going to be able to do the job. Because how can you logically sacrifice an animal on behalf of a man? How can you sacrifice an animal on behalf of a nation? It doesn't matter how many animals you sacrifice. But the Son of God, that's something different. That's something different. That is utter perfection. That is infinite value. That is a price to be paid that can be got from nowhere else. And that is why his sacrifice does the job. And no other sacrifice ever could. But not only is his sacrifice better, but so is his theatre of operations. Because this isn't him in an earthly setup. He doesn't serve at the tabernacle or temple, which was just a pale replica of the real thing. He serves in the very throne room of God, the courtroom of heaven. He's under the eye of God himself. He applies not to the mercy seat, as it was called, that lid on top of the Ark of the Covenant in the temple. But he does serve at the seat of mercy, the throne of mercy, where he's able to apply to God himself in his very presence. And it's there that he enters, this timeless priest, with his once for all offering of himself. And he goes there on our behalf, carrying the evidence of his sacrifice by the marks of his crucified body. How could God possibly ignore that? He cannot. And he sits there, approved, accomplished, everything. Job done. God satisfied, and he there forever a witness to the Father's eye that he has paid in full and written off completely everything that we would ever need God to forgive us for. Now you're either stunned, or you're just gobsmacked. I mean, really, if we could just grasp the enormity of what this is. And that's what Hebrews is asking us to do. But you see, not only is this priest surpassingly superior to all others, and his sacrifice completely and finally effective, and his realm of service the highest that can possibly be in the universe, but so is also the covenant that he puts into effect, superior in every way to what came before it. And that's what this goes on to tell us about. This is why Jesus had to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Because he's not trying to be a better version of what came before. He is a completely new person, a different order, a different league, bringing into being something that is totally different to what came before. He didn't come to patch up the old way, with all its shortcomings. He came to replace it. He came to bring in something that was infinitely better than what was there before. Let's read about it, shall we? It's in chapter 8 and verse 7. For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God found fault with the people and said, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenants I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." By calling this covenant new, he has made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. It's so much better to be living under this than the old one. How does it show itself as better? Well, the old one was characterized by putting an onus, a burden, on the people who were part of it. There was this characteristic phrase that kept coming up, wasn't it? "Thou shalt not." Or, "This is what you must do." go and do it or else. That's your part of the covenant. You break that side of it, sorry, that's it. Now I know, God wasn't like that with his people, was he? The endless mercy and grace of God went on. Why? Because God was still working at bringing something new into being and ensuring that it happened. But instead of that, thou shalt not, here we got repeated in this, I will. It's God saying, I will. I'll do this. I'll do that. And you will be this to me. The onus is shifted completely. It's no longer a burden on poor, weak, fault-ridden human beings as we are to try and keep up demands that are well beyond us. And to keep running back to God for forgiveness all the time and then feeling bad and then going back and doing it all over again. But it's God promising to inject into our lives the impulse to obey him. The love, the desire, the reaching out to him, the unhappiness at being something else and not doing. This thrust that he's promising to put into our hearts, and this understanding and this grasp in our minds. There's a whole new situation. He says he'll enable us to know him. I mean, what can be more wonderful than that? All shall know me, he says, from the least to the greatest. To know him in a personal way. To actually have dealings with God. No, to actually share life itself with God. And with a guarantee of forgiveness. For I will forgive their wickedness. I will remember their sins no more. What fantastic words they are. The old is gone. Yeah, it was necessary. God doesn't do things unnecessarily. It was a stopgap. There had to be something so God could bring this better thing into place. It was necessary because it was a preparation for what he was wanting to bring into place. Because we wouldn't know the value of what he was doing with the new if we didn't appreciate the problems with the old. We wouldn't realize just what he was achieving through the new if we didn't understand the principles that he shows us in the old. And it prepares us. The old is gone. And that's why Jesus both fulfills it and abolishes it at the same time. He does what the old was calling for. But at the same time he says that's over. We don't need it anymore. And what a scheme. You know, God himself takes on the responsibility for our lives. For us getting it right in future. And Jesus is the guarantor of that. And our part is simply to trust them to play their part. Jesus is the guarantor or the guarantee. It doesn't matter. There's different things in different versions. It amounts to the same thing, really. He does not. He cannot fail. We've already established that, haven't we? He is the guarantor. It's not down to us anymore, this relationship we have with God. It doesn't matter who we are. It's not about what we've done or what we've failed to do. It's not what kind of past we've got. It's not whether we qualify at all. It rests entirely on Jesus. Because that's who the covenant's made with. The Father is making a covenant with the Son for all those who belong to Jesus. and the arrangements made with Jesus himself. And God takes responsibility to make it work. It's not his way to forgive us and then push us out and say, right, you're on your own now, get it wrong again and I'm right behind you. Waiting to pounce. No. God takes the responsibility. That's what these words are saying. I will write my law on their minds, in their hearts. So what's our part? Well, it's to roll that responsibility onto God, isn't it? Surely. It's to see in him the power and ability to put those things into our lives and to effect them, because he said he will. To see that it's all anchored in Jesus, and he's never going to go back on that. And to roll that responsibility onto him. And when we get it wrong, and when we're struggling, this is what we need to remind ourselves about, isn't it? It's not down to me. It's not about whether I can be fit to meet God and ask for his help. It's not about whether I'm going to go wrong again tomorrow. It's about looking to God to fulfill his promise through the new covenant. I will, he says, write my laws in your minds and hearts so that you obey them. It's about us being open to him. But the work is his. The responsibility is his as we give it to him. You see, I look at Hebrews and I think, well, how relevant is that to us if we are talking about people who are back in the old Judaistic system of things, and but actually when I think about it, it's so easy for us to actually embrace the message of Jesus with an Old Testament mentality, to see him that as being no more than the perfect sacrifice that they couldn't offer but he has, being the perfect priest that they didn't have, but we do, and yet somehow treat the rest as though it is actually still the same. As though there's still the onus response is on us. We have to keep doing all the running. We have to live with this sense of burden on our lives about the problem of sin and how we keep right with God and all of those things that those people carry. This is a change. This is saying that's part of the old. The new is God saying he will do in us and through us what we cannot do for ourselves. And if we come to the right place and we see it aright, we have to go to God and say, actually, Lord, we cannot do anything for ourselves. And it's all your responsibility. The difficulty is living in that and holding on to it and working it out. But that's not this part of Hebrews. So I'm not going to talk about that. I'll leave that to somebody else. Just sufficient to say that what Jesus has done is bring in something completely new. That we would never want to go back to anything else for. And the other thing he's done is open up an avenue forward into something different, a new experience, a new place to be, a new door is opened in what Jesus has done. And again, that's something that Hebrews goes on to explain more fully and to encourage us into. And I will still leave that open for others to deal with.